I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Welcome to Talking Business, a podcast produced in Melbourne, Australia. The podcast is available on the Acast app, the Apple Podcast Store, or wherever you go to get your podcasts. Or you can get it at the Business Acumen website at www.businessacumen.biz. I am Leon Gettler. My job is to review and monitor the week's news in business, finance and economics. I bring it all to you every week. This is episode number 7 in our series for 2019, and today's date is Friday, March the 15th. First, I'll be talking to Simon Madder, the CEO of Prime Financial, and he'll share some interesting insights on the opportunities for smaller financial services firms in the wake of the Royal Commission, which has the banks retreating from the wealth management space. And I'll be talking to CommSec economist Craig James about what to expect from the market in the week ahead. But now, let's talk to Simon Madder.
Simon Madder, what impact is the Hayne Royal Commission having on the financial services sector?
Look, I think in its simplest form, it's shining a light on some practices that were no doubt fairly questionable, and it's making it very clear that putting the client first and making sure that advice that's in their best interest is the first and only thing that should be considered. And
hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
And I think that, if you kind of expand it out, there's a few other things that are happening around educational standards and making sure that the most qualified people are giving that advice that's in the best interest of clients is going to make sure that clients are well protected for the future. So I think across the education, the separation of product and making sure the best interest duties are focused on can only be a good thing for the client.
Nonetheless, it is having an impact on the industry, isn't it?
Yeah, I think it is having an impact on the industry. I think, if you look over the last probably 10 years, there's been various, whether you call them inquiries or moments between changes in legislation, whatever it might be, where everyone's just accepted that there needs to be better advice. And I think that longer term, and I'm hoping that through this inquiry it continues to occur, longer term, the real separation of the product and making sure that clients and the advice that they get is put at the forefront. So, yeah, it's absolutely, it's impacting the industry, whether it's a large institution, whether it's more probably what's considered, I guess, independent, albeit you've got to be very careful about the use of that term, but called non-bank-owned advisory firms. Yeah, absolutely, it's having an impact. And, rightly, clients are asking more questions, and that can probably only be a good thing, I would have thought.
It would mean, though, that every financial services firm would be having would need to double check their procedures, wouldn't they?
Absolutely, yeah, completely. I think that when you when you're giving advice to clients, you've got to make sure that you've got a reasonable basis for that, and you've got to make sure you have the technology that can track that you're actually delivering the service standards that you are promising to clients, be that reviews, be that the basis of the advice, how you collect the data, how you store data. All of those aspects play into it. And so I think, everything from conflicts about how you go about thinking about giving the advice to the client, to how you actually collect the data and then deliver that advice, I think everything has been brought into question, and rightly so.
Right. I mean, I wasn't too surprised by some of the findings of the Royal Commission, although some of them were very, very striking. What was your response?
Look, I think when anything like this is occurring, that you actively question your own procedures, your own processes that you're going through. And I think, from a board level all the way through management and then to the advisory level, you're checking and you're double checking that you're being as good as you can be around those things. Look, I think that, and I'm careful about how you state these sort of things, but the perceived or actual mis-selling of products to people, and whether that be on the banking front or the superannuation side of things around how SMSFs might have been promoted to people, I think those are some of the things that are quite, I won't say surprising, because you'd anticipate that there would be some things that haven't probably been done as well as they could have been, but that's been quite an obvious standout, I think, through that process. That, again, it goes back to where I started the conversation when you asked me the first question. If the client's best interests aren't being put at the centre of everything that you're doing, then and you're thinking, okay, we've got this product that we need to sell, and we need to be, and then the owner of that product is then seeking to incentivise people to sell more of it, I just can't see how that can work out well for the consumer or the client. So I think that product-driven process, and probably what the life insurance industry evolved out of, cutting that tail and really moving on is the key thing. So I think once that can be done and people take their responsibilities very seriously and act accordingly, then the outcomes improve. But some of the mis-selling and the mis-delivery of those things is highly concerning.
Well, the banks have actually been taking measures to address it. There's been all sorts of changes I've seen, particularly at all of them, actually, in response to the Royal Commission. And they're also, the very noticeable trend is that they're pulling out of wealth management.
Mm. It's interesting, isn't it?
What's your view about that?
Yeah, I think when you look back sort of the last 10 to 15 years probably even beyond that, that I think the concept of trying to deliver clients more services or additional products, you can see why banks decided to get more heavily involved with wealth management, superannuation and life insurance. You can understand the logic that they have put in place. And I think, probably even more broadly, if you look at it even further, maybe if you look at the investment banks as well, they've tended to suggest they probably don't really want to be involved with, in particular, retail financial advice moving forward. So I understand that some of the decisions that have been made, and to an extent, maybe some of it's been put in the too hard basket, and better off to focus on the core business of banking. So I think you can understand that. I think, when you talk to or you read press around, I think Westpac are probably the only one that have decided that they want to continue to have an involvement. They see the logic for their customers. That's interesting. So they're probably a bit of a standout. But you can understand, given some of the challenges that have been faced and probably trying to disentangle the product from the advice piece, why the majority of the banks and investment banks have headed away from it and focusing on what they, I guess, are their core business. For a firm like ours, we don't have a proprietary product. So for us, being able to deliver advice and services to customers has been the key thing for the last 20 years. So, that is our core business. We see an opportunity that will come from some of these changes that the banks are making and moving out of. And And there's lots of different dynamics playing out, whether it's the educational standards, whether it's banks moving out of wealth management generally, and then advisory groups like us wanting to grow and deliver more value to our customers and new customers. I think opportunities will present, and I think it's definitely going to get reshaped over the next few years.
And so you see this is going to present an opportunity for smaller companies to move into wealth management, obviously.
Yeah, I think so. And I think it'll be interesting to see whether or not I think there's been a perception, and we're going to be very careful when we're having this conversation as to which layer you're talking about within wealth management. Obviously, there's platform, and then there's funds management, and then there's advice. Then there's dealer groups and various other things. So you know, it's easy to lump everything in together and make pretty broad statements. But I think that smaller groups that want to attract high quality advisors that have the right educational qualifications, I think there'll be people that flow out of the banks and out of institutions that want to are used to having support and will need some support and won't necessarily go and get their own license and just try and do it themselves. So that will present an opportunity for companies like Prime and other people to play in this space. And, I think if there's 25,000 or thereabouts financial advisors in this country and the educational standards are going to change it the way that has been proposed, then, you could see a substantial drop off in numbers. So what is that going to mean in terms of how advice is delivered to clients if there's 20, 30 or 40% fewer advisors to do it and the need hasn't disappeared? Then, how's that actually going to play out? And presumably people that are already or continuing to operate in that space will be presented with opportunities for growth.
Well, the $64 question, of course, is what can these smaller companies offer that banks can't?
I think in its simplest form, personalised service. I think there's a challenge with getting too big. And I think, that if you don't have, and this is perhaps some of the things that have been become quite obvious, is that if you don't have the right systems and processes and you're not close enough to the customer or the client, then things can, the theory of what you're trying to do versus the practice can become quite different. So I think that if you've kind of built your business starting first with the customer or the client, then surely this environment, what you're going to do is continue to do more of that and hopefully get better and better at it with more robust processes and systems. So I think I'm not suggesting that the banks haven't in the past put clients first, but as you stated at the start, perhaps that's some of the instances that have come out here is that it's been more product-driven than advice or service-based. But I think it does present opportunities, absolutely, for us to keep doing more of what we do now, but hopefully in a growing environment.
Right. And so in a sense, you could actually make a better go of it than the banks because you'll be offering more personalised service.
I'd absolutely hope so. Our model has been built. We were founded by accountants as a business, and the concept of accountant coming from a particularly probably fiduciary basis where they've always had a focus on structure and the strategy for a client. I think that serves us well in our DNA. And as we've then moved obviously into superannuation and investment management. What we're trying to do is to have the client have a more complete experience with a trusted group of advisors where there's not, product isn't the central theme. I just think if you service customers really, really well and you focus on their needs, then the rewards will be long term. And so, I think we are well positioned. Absolutely.
Well, Simon, it's been great talking to you and it's going to be a very fascinating space to watch. Thank you very much for your time.
Thanks for the opportunity, Larry. Have a good day.
And now let's talk to ComSec economist Craig James.
Well, Craig James, what can people expect from the market the coming week?
Well, it all gets down to really US and China still. We're still waiting on resolution, so the US-China trade dispute, so negotiations, underway there. But, so that's the real issue. In terms of economic data, really what stands out, in a big way is the labour force figures, on Thursday. The job market's in really good shape, and that's sort of confusing a lot of people because they're looking at the economic growth figures and they're saying we're hardly growing. Then you look at the employment figures, and it shows that we've got an unemployment rate at a 7.5-year low of 5%. In fact, in New South Wales, we've got the lowest unemployment rate that we've ever seen in the monthly series. You have to go back to the early 1970s to see something like 3.9%. So we've got the job market in pretty good shape, and we expect that it remained in good shape. We're looking for a 15,000 gain in terms of jobs, you know, sort of over the month of February. So the job market's still in good shape. Yes, one way or another, we're going to have to get a resolution, you know, sort of the issue about, you know, so which one is correct. Is it the GDP figures, or is it the economic GDP figures, or is it the employment figures?
And it seemed that the last week's retail figures also showed that retail had slumped quite profoundly in New South Wales and Victoria, where there was good job growth.
Yeah, it's an interesting one. You know, sort of we look at, you know, the retail trade figures, and when you look at the headline retail trade, it looks as though, you know, so consumers are hardly spending. There is another component of that retail sales, and that basically is dealing with the large retailers. So retail sales works on a survey. We do know that each and every month the big retailers and the chains are always surveyed. And what that showed is for the latest month, the big retailers and chains showed retail sales growth of 0.4%. So that would suggest that there's not a problem at all, that people are getting jobs, people are spending, but the headline retail sales is showing another description. So we have got these disagreements, if you like, between the economic data that's happening around Australia at the moment, whether you look at, you know, sort of spending levels, whether you look at employment, and whether you look at, you know, broader measures of economic growth. In fact, you know, so there's one area of the economy that looks as though it's going gangbusters at the moment, and that's the export data. It's showing that we've got significant growth in exports right the way across the globe. It's not just China. It's not just Japan. We've got 73 countries across the globe where Australia is recording double-digit export growth. Now, if our economy was stalling in, you know, sort of big way, we wouldn't be seeing, you know, that degree of strength in terms of exports.
So why wouldn't that be showing up in the GDP numbers?
Well, I think what we're seeing is, you know, so exports, you know, are doing, you know, sort of okay, but, you know, so the imports are also rising at the same time. So the GDP figures work on net exports, exports less imports. And if imports, you know, sort of rising, due to the fact that we've got an infrastructure boom, you know, sort of here in Australia. Clearly, we need to bring in, you know, sort of new equipment for that infrastructure boom. If we're building, you know, sort of railroads, tramways, tunnels, and the like, clearly you need the equipment that's being brought in. So that may be, you know, sort of one issue at the moment. One of the other issues may be that Australian consumers, you know, sort of buying more goods from overseas rather than, you know, sort of domestically. So it is perhaps, you know, sort of case that the degree of choice that we're getting from overseas is causing people to buy goods online and buy it from other parts of the world, despite the fact that the lower Aussie dollar would suggest that, you know, sort of people should be buying it, you know, some more domestically. So, yeah, it's an interesting, you know, sort of discussion point that we're seeing, you know, in terms of the economy at the moment. Just what strength is it in? Just what shape is it in? Because seemingly, you know, we've got these indicators that, you know, sort of expressing, you know, sort of different verdicts on the whole issue.
So that's all quite confusing when you look at the overall picture.
Well, it is quite confusing, and you could understand why, you know, so the Reserve Bank governor is scratching his head and saying, look, we're going to have to get, you know, sort of some resolution of the issue. You know, it's the same, I suppose, when we were looking at the housing market. Sydney and Melbourne home prices are easing, and that's quite understandable given the fact that they basically rose significantly, you know, some more than, you know, sort of other capital cities. Now they're coming back to earth with more supply on the market. But you go to Brisbane, you go to Adelaide, you know, so you go to other parts of the country, and they're not telling you that there's a housing crisis. They're not telling you about substantially rising or falling in home prices. They're talking about, you know, sort of much flatter market, and one that's been, you know, so flat for quite some time. So Certainly, you know, sort of, if we're looking at sort of housing activity, it seems as though it's, you know, sort of this two-speed economy type thing, you know, so coming in again. The fact that we've got downspeed in terms of Sydney and Melbourne prices, but the rest of the country, you know, sort of in, you know, so much different sort of shape.
Right. Okay. So while we have to look out for the jobs figures, the big issue is the trade talks between China and the US, which is coming to high point next week.
Well, yes, you know, sort of, there's positive noises, and we're hearing these positive noises, but you're just wondering as to whether investors are just starting to get a little bit exasperated by the whole situation. I suppose what we've got to understand is that this is a very complicated set of negotiations that are underway, and perhaps we're thinking that, you know, sort of something like this will be solved very, very quickly, but this is some issues that, you know, sort of been not just around for years, but around for decades, and we're getting, you know, sort of progress, you know, sort of coming through. Certainly we do know that in terms of the positive noises coming out, but you know, it's the question of whether US and China want a full, complete deal, or whether they'd be happy with, you know, sort of partial issues, you know, sort of get resolved. And that's the issue, I suppose. We know that when the United States walked away from the talks with North Korea, that it didn't really get everything that it wanted, and, you know, sort of walked away. Now, if that's the issue with the US-China trade talks, well, we may have a similar sort of disappointment. What we need from both sides is a degree of give and take, and perhaps we don't get all the issues resolved, but if we can get some sort of agreement and a resolution to be able to talk on the other issues, I think that's something that, you know, sort of most people, you know, around the world could live with quite easily.
Nonetheless, so the question is whether the issues will actually be resolved. I mean, obviously it's in China's interest to get them resolved because their economy is slowing down quite profoundly. The American economy seems to be slowing down, and we're heading into an election next year, so it's in Donald Trump's interest to get this sorted out.
Yeah.
But at the same time, the question is whether the key issues of China's the Chinese government control of the economy can be resolved.
Well, yes, I suppose, yes, so that is, yes, sort of the major issue. I suppose what we do have, yes, is central, yes, government in Beijing, and then you've got, you know, sort of all the sort of little affiliates, you know, sort of out or the country around the countryside, you know, sort of, so they've all got to be, you know, sort of brought, you know, sort of into line. But I think, you know, sort of, because we've had the National People's Congress, you know, sort of, I think it should be made fairly clear, you know, sort of in that agenda, that what we do need is, you know, sort of, it's in the good of the interests, you know, the entire nation to be able to get some resolution. As you say, you know, so the Chinese economy slowing quite markedly, that puts a degree of pressure on them in an economic sense. But in terms of a political sense, certainly, you know, sort of Trump, he has had a limited success with the border wall, limited success with the North Korean negotiations, and if he was to also have limited success with the US-China, you know, sort of that would put a lot of pressure on him for a political standpoint. And, yeah, we are moving, you know, sort of through to, you know, so the big time in US politics, moving ahead, you know, into the next election.
Well, that'll be fascinating to watch, as will the employment figures for next week, particularly with us heading into an election in May.
Well, yes. It's interesting, though, that the positive and negative economic data doesn't seem as though it's having, you know, sort of much impact in terms of the voters. You know, sort of the general perception, you know, sort of, is that we might get some good, you know, economic data, but it's not resonating with the ordinary, you know, sort of Australian. So it's an interesting one, you know, sort of the government has got a pretty good story to tell when you think about it, you know, sort of in terms of the entire position of the economy. We've had 27 years without an economic downturn, without a recession. We've got low inflation, we've got the lowest interest rates that we've ever seen, we've got a job market, you know, sort of in good shape. You just wonder, you know, sort of what people, you know, sort of overly concerned with. And, you know, sort of generally if you had a government around the world that, you know, sort of such has good economic data, then you'd wonder why they weren't ahead in the polls. But, you know, there's other issues at play. You know, so it's the stability of the government, I think, probably, you know, sort of the stability, you know, sort of the participants of the government, which, you know, is the main issue for ordinary people. It's also the fact that here in Australia that once you've had, you know, sort of a couple of terms, you know, so there's a perception is, you know, say, okay, give, you know, the next mob a go and, you know, sort of see how they go.
Well, Craig, it's going to be fascinating to watch, and thank you very much for your update on what we can expect from the market in the week ahead.
It was my pleasure.
So what's happening in the news? Well, Boeing Company grappled with more groundings of its most important airliner as operators from Brazil to South Korea idled the 737 MAX following a second deadly crash, throwing the US manufacturer deeper into crisis. The fallout from the crash has weighed on Boeing stock and the share market, with questions swirling around the future of the newest version of its 737 family, a cash cow that generates almost a third of the company's operating profit. After China became the first major market on Monday to halt takeoffs and landings of Boeing's latest single-aisle model, flight halts quickly cascaded around the globe. Singapore barred all 737 MAX service in and out of the city-state, a move that was followed by Australia and Malaysia. The UK said it would halt flights for 737 MAX, and other European countries followed suit. Europe's aviation regulator prepared a similar action as the region joins a global rebuke of a US manufacturer's most important plane. The suspensions have put about a third of a 350-strong global fleet out of action. The bans in Singapore and Australia mean that the newest version of Boeing's best-selling model is now blocked from a key long-distance travel destination, as well as Singapore's Changi, Asia's second biggest international airport and a popular transit hub. And Prime Minister Theresa May's EU withdrawal deal has been rejected by MPs for a second time, throwing her Brexit strategy into further confusion. MPs voted down her deal by 391 to 242, a smaller defeat than when they rejected it in January. The PM said MPs will now get a vote on whether the UK should leave without a deal on the 29th of March, and, if that fails, on whether Brexit should be delayed. That's the most likely outcome. She had earlier warned MPs that if they did not back her improved deal, they risked no Brexit at all. But she failed to convince enough of them that concessions she had agreed at the last minute with the EU were legally binding changes they had demanded when they rejected the deal by 230 votes in January. Northern Ireland's Democratic Unionist Party, which keeps a government in power, voted against the deal, along with Brexiteer Conservative backbenchers. And the latest NAB business survey found there had been a broad-based decline in conditions, with key forward-looking indicators pointing to ongoing weakness. Business operating conditions in Australia have materially deteriorated in early 2019, posing downside risks for investment, hiring, and broader economic growth in the period ahead, according to the National Australia Bank's Business Confidence Survey for February. The NAB's conditions index fell 3 points to 4 during the month, dragged lower by weakening views towards profitability and trading conditions. The separate business confidence index also slipped by 2 points to 2, leaving it at the lowest level since January 2016. At the same time, consumer confidence is tanking, according to two opinion polls. The ANZ Roy Morgan Consumer Confidence Index tanked 4.8%, leaving it at the lowest level since late 2017. Sentiment towards family finances, with views on current conditions and those in the year ahead, slid 2.9% and 5.4% respectively, and views on current economic conditions tanked by 7.9%, while sentiment towards the economy looking 5 years ahead fell by a smaller but equally ugly 5.4%. And the Westpac MI index slumped 4.8% to 98.8, leaving it at the lowest level since September 2017. The main reasons cited were the December quarter accounts, which had Australia's economic growth slowing to a 1% annual pace over the second half of 2018, widely described as a per capita recession in media coverage, and the housing market downturn. And home lending is down by more than 20% in the last year, the biggest annual decline since 2008. New figures from the Australian Bureau of Statistics showed lending to households fell 2.4% in January, dragged down by a slide in the value of lending for homes. Lending to households for dwellings, excluding refinancing, was down 2.1%, with owner-occupier lending down 1.3%, which was better than market expectations of a 2% decline. And while the Queensland Nationals are pushing for coal-fired power station, and the Morrison government has not ruled out supporting coal, the Reserve Bank of Australia has warned climate change is likely to cause economic shocks and threaten Australia's financial stability unless businesses take immediate stock of the risks. The central bank became the latest Australian regulator to tell business they must analyse their investments. As the coalition grapples with an internal battle over taxpayer-funded coal-fired power and energy policy. In a speech to the Centre for Policy Development in Sydney, the Reserve's Deputy Governor Guy DeBell said challenges for financial stability may rise from both physical and transition risks of climate change. What if droughts are more frequent or cyclones happen more often, he asks. The supply shock is no longer temporary but close to permanent. That situation is more challenging to assess and respond to. Financial stability could be put at risk if businesses remained unaware of unanticipated insurance payouts, pollution-driven reputational damage, legal liability, and regulation changes that could cause valuable assets to become uneconomic. Dr. DeBell said the current drought across large swathes of the eastern states had already reduced farm output by around 6% and total economic growth by about 5.15%. That has an impact on monetary policy, Dr. DeBell said, citing the temporary shock of banana prices surging after Cyclone Yasi in 2011, which in turn boosted inflation by 0.7 percentage points. But he said future events may not be so one-off, with repeated climate events and the transition of the economy likely to have a longer-term impact. And ASIC is planning to target senior executives and company directors as part of a new police-style approach to enforcing the law. Under the new regime proposed by the Australian Securities and Investments Commission's enforcement specialist, Daniel Crennan QC, the regulator plans bringing prosecutions both large corporates, especially in the scandal-ridden finance sector, and individuals, particularly at executive and board level. Mr. Crennan's 125-page review of enforcement policies has a prejudice in favour of litigation and against negotiated agreement. Opposition leader Bill Shorten is preparing to legislate a living wage if he becomes Prime Minister, in a move that would boost minimum pay packets and embolden unions, but alarm corporate Australia just 2 months out from the federal election. Dismissing business leaders opposed to a rise as fat cats, the Labor leader foreshadowed a change in the law to encourage the Independent Fair Work Commission to set a higher minimum wage. Business threatened job losses within hours of Mr. Shorten's comments, which have placed industrial relations firmly at the centre of the impending election campaign. And the plan to abolish trailing commissions for mortgage brokers, as recommended by the recent Banking Royal Commission report, has been dropped by Treasurer Josh Frydenberg. Following consultation with the mortgage broking industry and small lenders, the coalition government has decided not to prohibit trail commissions on new loans, but rather review their operation in 3 years' time, he wrote in a statement. Mr. Frydenberg said the review will be conducted by the Council of Financial Regulators and the Australian Competition and Consumer Commission, and would also consider if upfront commissions would continue. NAB Interim Chief Executive Philip Chronican says he expects greater accountability and focus from senior figures at the bank when he becomes chairman. Mr. Chronican, who will replace Ken Henry as chairman once the yet-to-be-chosen new chief executive is in place, said board renewal was a priority and it was down to the bank's leaders to raise their game in response to the failings aired at the Royal Commission. I am confident in the strategic direction we have for NAB, Mr. Cronican said in a letter to shareholders. My expectation of the bank's leaders is that they implement our strategy with greater accountability and focus. Mr. Cronican said NAB, whose leadership was lambasted by Commissioner Kenneth Hayne, had let down customers, owners, community and staff, but had returned more than $110 million in refunds and remediation to 310,000 customers since June last year. Footwear startup Shoes of Prey has just entered into liquidation, with Kelly Trenfield and John Park of FTI Consulting appointed as administrators. Co-founder Michael Fox cited the company's failure to gain traction in the mass market, as well as its difficulty in competing with cheap Chinese manufacturers, as two driving reasons behind the collapse. And Sanjeev Gupta, the man credited with saving the iconic Whyalla Steelworks, is targeting a near $5 billion float of the Australian arm of his sprawling industrial empire in a move he hopes will quash speculation his business may be in trouble. Mr. Gupta said an initial public offering of the Australian business would show his companies can work under governance rules, being listed would bring transparency, and shows our model is successful. He added, being a listed company would also mean the discipline of publishing accounts as well as giving us a currency and market value which will allow us to do other things. The Whyalla plant became a totem of Australian industry in the carbon tax debate after then opposition leader Tony Abbott said the town would be wiped out by the Gillard government's planned carbon tax in 2011, and Trade Minister Craig Emerson responded in song. The Whyalla Steelworks owner Arium went into administration in April 2016 owing creditors about $2 billion and remained in limbo for over a year before being sold to Mr. Gupta's Gupta Family Group Alliance in 2017. Then South Australian Premier Jay Weatherill said the sale was a great victory for Whyalla and an extraordinary victory for South Australia. Arium provided about 3,000 jobs in Whyalla, a town of 22,000 people, when it went into administration, and its revival was heralded across a political spectrum. The New York hedge fund, Manukau Partners, has doubled down on its call for the board of accounting software company, MYOB, to reconsider a takeover offer from vaunted private equity firm KKR, demanding the company provide it with key documents related to the bid. In a letter addressed to MYOB Chairman Justin Milne, dated March 6, the hedge fund, run by former Australian Securities Exchange Director Shane Finemore, asked the company to provide it with a copy of a draft scheme booklet and independent experts report that was lodged with the regulator. Australian miner Newcrest, the third biggest gold producer by market value, agreed to an $806.5 million deal to add an Imperial Metals Corp mine in Canada, extending the spree of deal-making in the sector. Melbourne-based Newcrest, which is currently focused on mines in Australia, Indonesia and Papua New Guinea, will acquire a 70% joint venture interest in the Red Chris copper and gold mine in British Columbia and become the operator of the site, the producer said. The mine, on the northern edge of the Skeena Mountains, about 1,700 kilometres north of Vancouver, gives Newcrest a producing asset in North America and has significant development opportunities, the company said. And flooding in northwestern Queensland has meant the loss of as many as 52,875 cattle for the country's largest beef producer, the Australian Agricultural Company. A complete assessment of cattle numbers will occur as mustering by AACO and our neighbouring properties is undertaken over coming months, the company said in a statement to the ASX on Monday morning. AACO estimated it would cost between $6 million and $8 million to repair damage to property, plant, fencing, station and water infrastructure at the company's four Gulf of Carpentaria properties in Woondoola, Canobie, Dalgonally and Carrum. And that's it for this week. And next week I'll have a great interview with Mayfair 101 CEO James Mawhinney, who'll be talking about the Mayfair 101 IPO Wealth Fund, which has raised over $30 million from predominantly self-managed super funds. James believes there's been an expansion in the breadth of investment scopes from self-managed super funds, and thus is anticipating an uptick in investments in technology, both directly and indirectly. And I'll be talking to RMIT economist Sinclair Davidson, looking at the state of the economy in the lead-up to the election, and what it means for the federal budget due in 10 days' time. And of course, I'll be bringing you all the week's news. In the meantime, you can find me on Twitter at TalkingBizBRZZ, on Facebook and on LinkedIn. And if you want, leave a comment. Wishing you all a great week. Take care, be good. Looking forward to bringing you Talking Business next week.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, marketers, advertisers, and business owners. Find yourself chatting up the same audience in the same places using the same old lines? Maybe it's time to podcast the net further to catch your next customer. With Acast, there's plenty of fish in the sea with more than 100,000 podcasts and millions of listeners. So there's a perfect match for every business. Use our ad platform to cast your net, then narrow down using targeting such as demographic, show categories, audience segments, and more. Find your match, then reel them in. Advertise on more than 100,000 podcasts with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.